Good evening. You're listening to WKCR FM New York. That's 89.9 on the dial and on the World Wide Web at www.wkcr.org. Tonight, you'll be listening to Art Waves, and I'm your host, Mary Brakowski. This is an interview with the artist Michael Broad, who owns a gallery on East 88th Street here in New York City. Michael is speaking about his work as an artist, his background living in Los Angeles, studying in the University System of California, working in ceramics and the juvenile justice system as an art teacher, and moving into poetry, what it means to work as an artist today, switching between different worlds that also end up not being that different, like Wall Street and making art. The current installation is Whoever Emerges, which is open to the public at Gallery 221. Michael sat down with me to discuss his background and his current installation, his influences, and why he makes art.
My name is Michael Broad. I'm an artist. What more of an introduction do I need?
That's great. Now you have to defend yourself. Can you talk about some of your previous work and your work as an artist, your background? You're from
well,
LA.
I grew up in Los Angeles. I got my college education and my graduate school education in the California State College and University system. And my initial contact with the arts was through clay as a potter. My interest began in high school. I worked commercially for some years for other potters. And then I think I slowly evolved into thinking about what I was doing from a different perspective. And I had the luck of coming in contact with instructors and professors who questioned me in ways that caused me to question myself about what I was doing, and was there something else I could do besides make bowls and plates and lampshades and lamp bases. And
But that was satisfying at the time that you did it? Or did it become sort of mundane? I mean, if you were doing it commercially, it would probably change also.
It became routine and a lot of work. I mean, it's difficult physically. I mean, you could be moving 600, 700, 800 pounds of clay during the course of an afternoon, picking it up, putting it down, moving it here, moving it there. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the reward wasn't commensurate with the effort that I was having to extend. And it was very commercial activity. But it provided me with a significant amount of training and skills that later were very advantageous for what I decided to start thinking about more seriously, which in my case were domes. And it seemed like I created one or two while I was in a state of play on the potter's wheel, and I looked at them, and then there was a kind of confluence of the dome shape, and then I kind of looked up in the air and began to see all these domes that's part of architecture that I had seen either in books or in my travels. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that this thing, this dome, was really a universal symbol. They were in all cultures throughout the world and existed since primitive times when men stacked up rocks on top of dead people, when bodies were buried under stones that formed mounds or domes.
Can you talk about that, the idea of being a ceramicist and, you know, finding a form that you feel has a deep meaning, but sticking to it? The idea of repetition might seem boring to some people.
Well, it's not. It potentially is boring, except if, because I'm was trained as a potter, everything I can produce domes of infinite shapes. And over the years, I've discovered that in those infinite shapes, they're gender. Some of them are very gender specific. Some of them are male. Some of them shapes are female, and some of them are androgynous in a way. But you mentioned something that's interesting. stick. Domes rarely exist on their own. They're always attached to something. So for me, it was a logical extension as I thought about it to think, well, now I'm making these cool domes and I like them, and people look at them and say, oh, these are very nice, or they're very sexy, or they can't stop but put their hands on them. You know, they have to touch them. So what am I going to do with them? So I started to put them on things. And first I put them on walls, and then I began to think, well, it's really just a shape. It doesn't have to be considered a shape. When you looked at it, I didn't want people to look at it and think, ah, it's ceramic. So I had to mask the clayness of it, which led me to painting them. And when I attached them to things, it allowed me to model the dome actually into the surface I was sticking it on.
So you started attaching them to things, and then, I mean, they change as objects by attaching
them. Yeah, because I began to think about art, and then the next question I posited to myself was, where's the edge of art? Painters, they have a specific edge. There's a frame. There's only so many square feet or square inches of canvas, and that's it. Sculpture, for the most part, it's the same thing to the degree that it's built out of materials, and the materials have a form and they have an edge. But when I started to put things on walls, I began to think, well, gee, is the whole wall now part of the piece?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the command? How much of the space or the surface that my dome is on does the dome assume control over in terms of being a focal point and having a plane, a spatial plane around it, made of a wall or something else?
Can you speak about any great influences on you in terms of other artists or professors?
I think certainly from my graduate school days, one of the most influential people in how I thought about what I was doing was Richard Archwager, who was invited to teach a graduate course out at Davis when I was a student there. And one of the projects that Richard began when he was in Davis at California were these what looked like little blips that he would attach to things. I realized much later that they were actually the shape that remained in a computer card that had been punched. The contemporary name for that, I guess, would be a Chad from the Fine Florida campaign. In any event, Richard's imagery was the space, the shape of the space left once the Chad had been stamped out of the card. And he produced those in wood, and he also produced them in a sort of adhesive vinyl, and he would go around putting them on things. And I realized after some time that what those really were spaces. And its effect, at least on me, when I encounter one of those, whether it was placed on a billboard or a building or any other location, was that it caused me to think about what another dimension of the thing I was actually looking at, the implication being that there was suddenly a hole in it. And you could peer inside it at section view, so to speak, even if you couldn't actually see the real section. But it caused me to think about things in a new way. I found that to be a sort of pervasive influence from that point forward. And the other thing that Archwager seemed to be focused on during that period was surface. I think certainly his Celotex paintings and drawings reflected that, where you had this... The surface itself as a plane became very nebulous. And I think that my use of Zolotone and similar types of products was an attempt to capture that same sense of vaporousness that could be produced as an effective surface.
I mean, what was your life like as an artist there? You were making domes in L.A.? I mean, you were teaching, you were...
After graduate school at UC Davis at the end of the 60s, I moved back to Los Angeles, built a studio in Venice, about a block from the beach, became a member, so to speak, in the art community in and around Venice and West Los Angeles. and started to make things. The next big installation I did, that time I was still putting domes on walls. I'd added a particular kind of paint to it to help model the image and to take more control over the surface that I was attaching the dome to. And as seeing as how it was Los Angeles and it was a very car-centric culture, and I grew up there with my collection of cars and so forth, I began to do cars as rolling installations, so to speak. And that involved attaching domes to cars on various spots, whether it's a fender, the hood, or the roof, or the trunk, modeling mm-hmm. the dome into the surface of the car, and then painting the entire car with a
with the
same uniform color or color that modified itself the further it got away from the dome. Mm-hmm. I was able to do this because of the material, which is called Zolatone, allowed me to introduce different flakes of color into the paint medium as I went along.
Can you talk about just your work, your installation work, the work that you put out for people to view in the public and receive in Los Angeles and Venice Beach?
Well, there I did an installation on the beachfront and two storefronts that was called Whoever in Transit, and it was you only could observe it through the windows. It wasn't an installation which the viewer could walk into. And it consisted of an oversized coffin that I'd built with multiple facets, like almost a cut stone, that had a peephole in it, like one of those glass fisheye peepholes people put indoors. And it rested on a bier that was maybe 9 feet by 4 feet high. And then there were two stamped metal chairs from about the 30s that were in there facing the bier. And I covered the entire surface of the store inside, the walls, the floor, the bier, everything but the coffin and the chairs in this acoustic material that looks like a cottage cheese, coarse cottage cheese when it's sprayed up. And then on top mm-hmm. of that, I used my multicolored paint. So the thing I was trying to achieve was that you would look at these surfaces and you would have the urge to see where does it really begin, so that the surface gets very soft visually. And it's not like looking at a polished sheet of metal or a flat plane of wood or a well-painted wall where it's flat. You know exactly where the wall is. With this cottage cheese and flaked paint on there, it's really kind of hard to tell where the solid surface was. Hmm. And then in the next storefront, I just used the paint. I modeled it from red to green, and in the back wall of the store, it was a rectangular store, maybe 12 feet wide and 20 feet deep and maybe 10-foot ceilings. I had about a 3-foot dome modeled onto the back wall, so you were like looking inside, and it was an internal installation in a way. Fully contained within this storefront, you couldn't go into it. You looked at it, you saw the walls sort of changed from red to green, and as you got to the back wall here was this massive dome that was part of the back wall protruding out from it.
So do you think the effect you were trying to give would have been broken if someone could go into it, to walk inside?
No, but, you know, in the early 70s, the type of people who propagated the beachfront in Venice, I would have had people sleeping in the storefront. So partly it was for security purposes that I kept the doors closed. Well, before I realized there's some other element in the yeah. in the current installation that I didn't mention, which sure. are the two dome poems that are on the front windows that take up the full window. And the words are typeset in a dome shape. And that really was, we're talking about this period in the early 70s when I was in Los Angeles. At the same time, I took a job working for the county superintendent of schools office in the juvenile hall system of L.A. County. And in my general life experiences, that was probably one of the most moving times in my life. And the only way I could sort it out was to write poetry. And so it was during that early period that I began to write and to arrange these things in the form of domes, in the shape. And so that's how I wound up with the dome poems.
Which is a sort of, you're fusing two different forms of art.
Right, the oral and the visual.
Well, can you just talk more about poetry, your poetry, and the poetry that you wrote at the time? I mean, what do you, when you say it was a incredibly impactful, meaningful time in your life, why was it? I mean, one could assume, but could you tell us?
Well, I was running a classroom probably with an average of 20, 21 or 22 boys. I was on the boys' side for a number of years. And a kid was arrested at night. He'd be in your class the next day. So there was, and it was the beginning of the Crips and the Bloods. These gangs were just forming and establishing a presence in Los Angeles and had modeled themselves on the Hispanic gangs, mostly Mexican at the time, that then, of course, became Salvadoranian and Honduran and Guatemalan. But it was very intense emotionally, very intense physically, very confrontational, continuous, endless fights. And it just, I'd go home and stare at the ceiling and I'd say, what am I doing here?
What were you teaching them?
I was the art teacher for a while. I took over from an ex-cop from Chicago. John Murray was his name, and he taught me a couple of tremendous lessons that I carried with me the rest of my life anyway. One, that you had to give children a choice, and then if you could push it, you had to give them a certain amount of time to make up their mind in. And my classroom was arranged where there was like five or six places. In each place there was paper folding or this material or that material, and the job of the kid was he had to make a decision, you know. Do this, do that. But, you know, you can do A, B, C, or D. You got 10 seconds to figure it out. If you can't figure it out, I'll help you, and I'll tell you what to do. Right. And that always worked. And the other one was, if you have to break up a fight, always grab the loser. Never grab the winner, because the loser will come back for revenge.
Wise words. Can you read us some of the material that you wrote about your experience in the juvenile justice system as a teacher?
Yes. The facility that I was working at when I started writing these things was the Central Juvenile Hall for Los Angeles County. And the catchphrase for the place, it was called Central. So this is a piece I wrote for Central. Bright sun, high walls, the terminal tragedy, ranting on through the cosmos. Lady, give me my keys. Hit the electro-wired lock of locks, out, in, close. Corridors filled, flowers, trees, shadows, fences, chain-linked forests. Toothbrushes, combs, model airplanes, roadman's rags, three square with watery eggs, roaches, rat shit, and macaroni. $100 doors for each room. Yard's a dull place, dead grass, mud puddles, concrete cliffs with light bulb eyes watch divisions of America in tennis shoes, tattoos, cement. God's child labor, pennies an hour, and dozens of eyes watch you when you eat, when you shit, when you mount your mattress and ride old memories to ecstasy. A Benares of the West, Ciudad de los Muertes, they watch you die.
You didn't share your poems with
the
students?
Yeah, because I was writing them in class. Kids could come up and
really?
Look over my shoulder and say, oh, Mr. Broad, what are you doing? I'm writing some poetry. You ever tried it? Oh. They'd look at you and say, well, I said, go back and take a shot. Let me sit here and finish this one. So I enjoyed that sort of rapport. The next one, which I'd like to read, if I can find it here, is Roll Call. Jungle Stones, Big Tong, Mr. Cool, T-John, Clay Nigga, Mad Papa, Bulldog Say, Tiger Tiger, Get on Zebra's Ass, 8 Triple Trey, Big Bo, The Atom, Nigga Charlie, Morte, Bro Lucky, Fool Ass, Mr. Sweet Tooth, High Class Hustler, Moneymaker, Lady Sweet Tooth, My Wife, Baby Tooth, my son. Fuck the rest, too sweet the best. Too sweet the only, all the rest are phony. Ratman, West Side, Underground, Frog, Compton, Shotgun, Mean Joe Green, Mr. Boo Too, Sir Mo, Lil Earl, Lil Avalon, Lil Wolfman, Lil Red, Big Payback, Gangsta Fred, Big AC, Baby J, Kool-Aid, Mr. Mumble, Black Mafia, The New Mafia, Black Ghetto Boys, Zoom, From the Block, Swing Swing, Mr. X.
Yeah, read another one.
Yeah, man. Every day they do that here. Crazy motherfuckers. One went yesterday and the day before that. Shit, you got a plan. Be patient. You can do it. Shit, I've busted out of every joint I've been in, forever hiding in manhole covers, the closet, the head, the cage, school cabinets, bushes. 2 days later, he was gone. Niggas always AWOL on holidays.
How many poems do you have about that?
I don't know.
During that period?
Maybe there were 20, 25. I haven't really kept track.
And you didn't write poetry before?
Well.
Did you scribble in a journal or anything?
Yeah, I did some journal work, works in journals. But this is the first time I decided to think about it with this image in mind, this idea that I could put them all into shapes and that reading them would, in fact, describe the shape based on how the letters lined up. Hey, I'll read one more. I was always fascinated by the fact that criminals in prisons and facilities to house them are always built to so well that I always thought that, God forbid, something should happen to the world, it would all come apart. They'd be the only people that would be left because they would be in all these hardened facilities. So I wrote a poem about it. Should the end come, only institutionalese would survive in their cement and steel barracoons. Advance wave of mutants with the double X chromosome. But in terms of figuring it out, writing poetry was to take all these thoughts and images that I had in my mind, which inevitably became narrative images, word images, oral images, and try to put them on paper and edit them out.
Is it because, the thoughts and emotions you were dealing with, they couldn't be dealt with in the artistic forms that you'd already been using?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because the environment was essentially verbal. Mm-hmm. I mean, the kids would stand and they'd mama talk, they'd trash talk, and it would just, the language was just magical. But it was always geared toward a kind of violence, and often it had a lot of humor in it. Mm-hmm. So this street language coming in face to face with the language that I understood and grew up with, it was created this sort of amazing thing that I felt I wanted to do something with. And then the only thing I could do with it was to keep it in the oral form and just write.
So did you notice that any of the, did they enjoy the art classes when they weren't killing each other?
Oh yeah. Art, is a very positive experience for most people. The basis to start, at least from my perspective, any art program is not to try and impose an idea on children, certainly, but children generally like to do things with their hands, mm-hmm. and to see what they're doing and use that as a jumping off place and try and get them to develop what it is they're already doing, as opposed to coming out of left field and saying, well, you have to do it this way or you have to do it that way.
Right.
And I had a lot of success with that. And in fact, I had enough success with that so that other people heard about it, and I was invited to lecture on the subject at a couple of local colleges and then eventually at the University of Washington in Seattle.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Broad, artist and gallery owner, Gallery 221, and creator of the new installation, Whoever Emerges, which is open through the summer.
At some point in the 80s, after doing a number of installations besides the one on the beachfront, I had a swim club that I had done as a piece that I was living in Los Angeles, and people would drive by, and every once in a while someone would stop and say, "What's this?" And so over the course of a few years, some of the people who asked me about it said, "Well, would you do my place?" And so that turned into I did theater in Beverly Hills for Milton Katsalas, who was a director and a prominent theater teacher. I did a couple of stores. I did the First City Cafe's interior, and they all consisted of this multi-flake paint job and domes that were attached to the surfaces in various locations.
So it was your art sort of became a sort of interior design for people in a way?
Yeah,
absolutely. Or people were desiring to have their residences or businesses become a piece of art, even?
Well, let's just say, no, I would say probably that they were thinking, the client was thinking more about, oh, this is cool, it would look nice, it's decorative, and I'm thinking, hey, well, if you want me to paint your place, you know, these are my rules.
Right.
It has to, I have to be allowed, you want it, I want to make a piece of art out of it. And that's how I proceeded. So regardless of what their intentions or desires were, my intention always remained the same, and the piece invariably became a work of art. In addition to the theater and other commercial and residential installations, I also did two pieces for the original Los Angeles Children's Museum downtown, which were quite nice, very large walls that had were Zola-toned and had domes on them.
Did the material in any way change by the fact that it was a children's museum?
No, because the Zolotone itself produces a texturized kind of surface. It invites touch. And so much of the Children's Museum was about touching and feeling, mm-hmm. and the fact that the material itself could be scrubbed clean made it very, very apropos in a children's museum. You asked what happened next. Well, you know, I was an only child of divorced parents, and my mother ran away when I was an infant. I was born in New York, but wound up growing up in Los Angeles. And one day, my phone rang, and it was my father, and he was crying about the fact that his latest wife had died, and that was number 5, and he'd been married to her for quite some time. And I sat there listening to this man on the phone. I really didn't know who he was, and so I decided to fly back and see him. And I was making some money in this installation activity, so I'd make some money, I'd get on an airplane, fly to New York, and hang out in his office. And did that for about a year, and finally thought, you know, I have to commit myself. I just can't keep doing this. My father's sole interest in life, I think, really was money, although he was a very curious person. He seemed to be compulsively obsessed with this idea of money. He was a member of the New York Stock Exchange, not a particularly successful one. And his first comment to me when he learned that I was a potter was, well, at least you'll always have a pot to piss in. So that, I think, sort of summed up my father's attitude to what my activities had
really?
Been. But since I'd never grown up with him, what he thought really didn't make any difference because I'd never spent any time with him, so I really didn't care. Anyway, so I gave up everything in Los Angeles and moved to New York, and wound up taking the various exams that qualify you to be a stockbroker, then a principal of a brokerage firm. And then after a few years, I wound up assuming I ran this company, and we built it up and went through the crash in 87. Finally, there came a time after about 8 or 9 years with him that I realized everything my mother had to say was true. And
so you completely changed your life. To a lot of people, I think that is surprising. One, L.A. and California are so different. Two, you were an artist, and then you go into Wall Street, which is just seems like such a strange world. And I mean, could you talk more about that change in your life, that seemingly abrupt change, sounds to me?
Well, it was abrupt, but in a way, you know, making art is like learning how to ride a bicycle. Once you learn to ride, you never really forget. And if you have the memory, and art is also a way of thinking and interpreting and looking at the world. So I carried all that with me down to Wall Street, along with my nail bags, and which I hung in the office on my first day because I was very intimidated. And here were these people with MBAs and Eastern college educations and number crunchers. And what was I? I was an artist. So they asked me what my nail bags were doing in the office one day. And I said, well, I just want to remind myself that I have some skills. When all this blows up, I can still go out and get a job. So they thought that was funny. But I realized that there were the people who I gravitated toward in the street were very creative people, manic depressives. They all had similar mindsets to the artists I'd known for the most of my life. And I'm still remained close with some of these people who I find incredibly creative and very curious as two essential ingredients to being an artist.
So did you start working again while you were also on Wall Street? Did you start doing
art? While I was on Wall Street, I located a pottery that facilities I could use, and I went back and started making more domes and started collecting stuff, essentially, things that I would make, i.e. the domes, obituaries, with the knowledge, and I obtained a space. So I had a small studio, which was this storefront, and it served me as a refuge in a way, and as a place to store the things that I was collecting, with this idea that at some point the sufficient mass of material will meet a more precise vision in my head, and there'll be a convergence of the materials I've collected with the things I've been thinking about, and a piece of work, an installation in this case, will emerge, which is what happened.
So you think that the different experiences you were having, i.e. a career change or a different world that you were living in, enriched your art, changed it?
I think everything enriches art. I mean, Helen Frankenthaler once said that the world is a very corrupt place, but artists are like cockroaches. They consume everything, and they can never be stamped out. So everything is grist for the mill. And that includes my experiences in Wall Street and with the people I've met. All of this has had some impact on shaping how I think about things.
So it's interesting listening to you talk to hear sort of that, you know, being an artist is not necessarily about the medium, though you have specific mediums you work with, but it's also a state of mind.
Definitely. And which reminds me of an obituary I read maybe last year for Richard Darman, who was head of the Office of Budget and Management. And since Washington is comprised of a lot of golf courses and people who have activities, hobbies, if you will, or ways to get away from things. And so the interviewer was asking Darman what he did for a hobby. And Darman said his hobby was thinking. He didn't play golf. He didn't play tennis. He didn't go boating. He just liked to think. And I spent a lot of time just doing that. I thought that was a remarkable thing to hear someone actually say.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking, but they feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
Because we're this sort of work-driven culture, and if you aren't in some state of mind where you're actually producing thoughts does not seem to have the same value as producing widgets.
Tell me about your current installation and the gallery space and where the idea came from, how long it's been up, etc.
Well, I have the installation, which is titled Whoever Emerges, has been up for 5 or 6 weeks now, maybe a little bit longer, in a small space at 221 East 88th Street. It's a storefront. The size is approximately 100 square feet.
Can you describe the installation more, the content?
Yeah. The installation is really an assemblage of collections and of obituaries and objects that I've produced. Typically, there are 380 obituaries from The Economist that cover about 12 years that are laminated in plastic and pinned to the walls. There's a coffin, which I made, that contains about a 34-inch artillery round, which sits in the front window. There's a uniform. There's a lot of rocks. There also is a cairn with a ceramic dome that's glazed in a copper luster that's protruding from the top, and two additional domes over the doorway that goes into my office, which is framed in a Shinto door frame.
I mean, that's a description of what is in the installation, but what would you say it's about?
The installation's about life and death. The coffin, the artillery shell, the empty uniform are all symbols of death in a way. And the obituaries are symbols of life. Each obituary contains a remarkable story about an individual that express and talk about the lives that these people have led. And most of them are quite remarkable.
Why did you choose to use The Economist as the source of the obituaries? Perhaps, I mean, some people that have come into the exhibit have seen, have asked, you know, why aren't there different sources? Why isn't there a uniformity, something that links everyone that's already dead, you know, here, like something about them that's common? You know, people are always looking for some sort of understanding of why you did, you know, this and made this choice and did that thing, you know.
Well, I think the choice was that I've been The Economist obituary is precise. They all run 1,000 words, each has a picture, and they're all on one page. So the uniformity alone gave them an edge as far as my view of the use of these things as objects in my installation. And then the writing, because it's limited to 1,000 words, is so elegant that if I was choosing to have an expression of life as elegantly presented as possible in narrative form, I didn't think, and I have yet to find, any obituarists who can do it as well as The Economist writers.
So you've described the installation by listing things that are in it, and then you've described what to you it's about. But I kind of want to know a little bit more about why you had the urge to create it.
I guess it really is a confluence of what I think about art in general and my collection of things, or my building of things. And finally, you know, sufficient mass is created and the piece came together. In other words, I finally looked at this mountain of obituaries and said, aha, there's a sufficient quantity to establish the kind of presence I want these to have in the space that I've...
So you realized you were saving them for a reason?
Oh, yeah.
Clipping things from magazines and things like that, I think, can seem, in the process of doing it, can seem sort of like, you know, why am I doing this? It's just more paper in my house. So did you ever have that feeling, or did you always envision there would be some future use for it because you collect things with a purpose?
No, that's essentially it. I collect things with a purpose. I may not actually be able to say what the purpose is, but somewhere inside there's a thread of reasoning that why I'm assembling this collection of stuff that I expect to use at some point in the future to express an idea with, or to become part of an expression of an idea.
I wanted to talk about, well, earlier you mentioned, you know, the edge of art and exploring what that is, literally meaning like, you know, the edge of a canvas or a space, but also I wanted to know if that could be linked to some of your influences in the avant-garde and that edge of art, you know, what is considered art by the status quo of art and how it can change.
Well, I think that for me at least, the avant-garde, which is that period in the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, art began to reflect on itself. It really became narcissistic. You could make art just about art. It didn't have to be about the trees or the landscape or the this or the that. And it clearly separated itself from the decorative arts. And I think certainly in writing, I was influenced by the futurists, the Italians, who took the actual layout of the manifestos and the poetry they were writing and tried to express the some visual idea using the layout of the words. And they threw out punctuation, and they threw out lots of the basic structure of language as it had been used in at least in the written form, the spoken form. And in France, in Paris, there was Guillaume Apollinaire, who sort of was one of the great promoters of the avant-garde and also a tremendous writer, who used a similar kind of format to express himself in. So that was very helpful to me because it was freeing. It allowed me, it gave me a foundation for arranging and typesetting my poems into the shape of domes. And by trying to remain consistent, that I'm not making box poems or star poems or submarine poems. They're all domes. It's all a variation on this one kind of universal shape for me. Right. So that was certainly one of my influences. And it also gave, you know, the avant-garde gave artists a kind of freedom to make art about themselves. Up until then, art was always about something outside of the artist. And now with the avant-garde, the artist turned his vision inside. And during that period, you know, there was we entered the First World War. Society transformed completely from what had been. Now suddenly here's this whole new world, and it wasn't particularly pleasant. So that's where my influence really, I think, the foundation of how I think about things comes from.
I mean, it's funny because that was over 100 years ago, and still there seems to be confusion. I mean, I would say that kind of art is still avant-garde. There's a confusion about the decorative versus self-reflective or modern art, if you want to use that loaded term. There's a confusion about it. I mean, if someone sees a painting of a landscape, they're comfortable with that, and they know it's art. You know, if someone were to come into Gallery 221 and see a bunch of paintings, they would be like, oh, this is nice, you know. But instead, they come in and they are confused. And the more patient and perceptive take something away. That's my judgment. But other people just don't seem to get it, you know. I think I think that avant-garde is still avant-garde, you know. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think that the reflection that art produced from the avant-garde forward was disturbing to a lot of people, because it essentially expressed the inner rancor that was going on in human beings during that phase in the human's history. And probably, you know, the Picasso's Guernica is one of the great expressions of that.
Right.
So, and it always disturbs people. People don't like to have a mirror held up to their most dangerous thoughts, at least as they might see them, or their most disturbing thoughts. And art began to mirror a lot of these disturbances that people were experiencing and artists were able to articulate.
Next, Michael reads two of the dome poems, his signature dome poems, that appear on the window panes of the gallery housing his newest installation, Whoever Emerges.
Well, this is the poem that's one of the poems on the front window of the installation at 221 East 88th Street. And the poem is in the shape of a dome. It covers the window. It's probably 4 feet wide and about 5.5 feet high. And the poem is the graphics for the poem are lettering that's printed, vinyl lettering that the general stores use when they want to put a sign in the window. The title of this piece is Whoever Emerges. It's on one of the front windows of the installation, also by that name, Whoever Emerges. Whoever on the road, whoever still traveling, whoever says whatever, whoever is dead, long live whoever. On the road, sleeping with whoever, wants out, whoever in repose, hip-hop whoever, whoever copes, whoever resurrected, whoever on the front, whoever goes down, whoever takes some lead, 15 minutes for whoever is gone. Goodbye, whoever in transit.
Do you think that these poems are meant to be read or to be read aloud, or how are they to be absorbed in your mind, or is there not a way?
I read them from the bottom left up and around to the bottom right. The poems also lend themselves to being read traditionally across the page. In my recent work, which are sort of assemblage poems, they can be read in multiple ways. And so, because they're visual, I'd like to think that there's a kind of, you have the freedom to look and interpret the shape the way you want to interpret it. You should be able to look at the words and put them together in ways that may be meaningful to you that the artist or myself did not intend initially when I wrote the poem.
So are these assemblages something new? Are you still writing the dome poems, or are you leaning more towards the assemblages? And can you describe them a little more?
Well, one of the quick digression, automatic writing was another thing that got popularized somehow, particularly during the Surrealist period, where it was a sort of magic. It like appeared on the page. And when I started reading The Economist or reading anything, I might find a saying that outdoor sculpture park, now open. I'll cut it out. And I'll think, well, maybe I can use some of this in a poem. So after a while, I've collected a number of these trimmed bits of language. And they'll all be on my work table in front of me. And I'll just kind of stare at them, and pretty soon a poem will self-assemble in my mind, and I'll select words, or I'll cut and trim a word out here, a word out there, and then I'll begin to arrange them in an order, in what for me is a readable order, following the shape of a dome. And I have a number of sheets of paper that I've had in inventory for many years that I painted a long time ago, which all have domes on them. And so using those as a basis for these pieces, I'm assembling these poems on these domes that reflect these dome shapes.
But I mean, have you been, is this like a new thing for you, a new form, or have you been doing it for a while?
I've been creating these kinds of poems probably for the last 6 or 7 years.
Because I wonder, you know, the dome poems that you have quite a few of, and I guess you started writing when you were teaching, they're visual, but they don't incorporate, you know, imagery. Like, there are images in some of these, right?
They're pictures and images along with the words. And that because they come from a number of different sources, the fonts, the typefaces, and so forth are all different.
Well, can you talk about your decision to, you know, come back to art full time? Just, you know, this period that you're moving into, you're no longer working on Wall Street.
I guess I finally became so weighted down by my collections of stuff, either things that I made, such as domes, or painted paper, and my collections of words, my collections of obituaries. I have other collections of other things that at some point will probably find their way in. That I feel that I just I had to get rid of it, and I can't. I'm very hard for me to throw anything out without trying to turn it into something else. And the only thing I know how to turn things into are really art and ideas. So now I have a plethora of ideas and an uber plethora of things to express those ideas with, and that's how I came to deciding that the art is now what I want to spend really the rest of my time on.
So is your hope to use your gallery space as a vehicle for your various projects, or do you want to, you know, showcase other artists there?
I've occasionally showcased, and exhibited work by other artists while I was still in the preparatory stages for my own expression. I'd like to be able to export what I have in there now to some other site, or a variation of what I have in there to accommodate whatever site might be made available for it.
So to have the installation travel.
Yeah. Put it back in transit, as
it were. I hope it does, yeah.
I think my goal, in a way, is I remember once years ago reading a piece about Louise Nevelson, who, in the course of her life, amassed vast collections of stuff, oceanic art, primitive art. Mm. And as she approached the last quadrant of her life, she eventually got rid of everything, and her life was reduced to a couple of file cabinets and the things she needed to make her art with, and everything else was she disposed of. And I thought that was the way to really sort of go out right.
The Economist is a magazine that a lot of people recycle every week, and you chose to give it a different context in life.
But yeah, I thought it could be, these obituaries could become part of something larger that related to the fact that these people were all dead. I'm always fascinated by the people who come in and look at this space and say, are these people all dead? But I think, you know, your question about gathering bits and scraps of pieces of things, I think that biologically we're really social animals. We're not much different than bees or ants or other things, termites that group together in large colonies.
Cockroaches.
And those colonies collect stuff, and we are collectors. As humans, we want to collect things. I think it's almost a biological imperative that in the course of our life, humans collect stuff. They either make things, and the things they make stick around and become collected objects, or they just collect things.
Yeah.
Friends, books, records, cars, you name it.
What was that like, the opening of your Whoever Emerges installation? What was the reception?
The reception was fantastic. There was probably 60, 65 people showed up, maybe a few more. And they spent some time looking at all this assemblage of rocks and coffin and shell and uniform and reading the obituaries and having the experience that all of this assembled in their mind to create a sensibility about life and death that they might not have had before. It might not have all converged or been forced on them through the experience of the installation. So for me, it was very gratifying to have people come and say, well, this is fantastic. I mean, how did you think of all this? I mean, it created a curiousness among the people who looked at it, which for me is a very important element in the appreciation of anything that somebody does, whether it's make art or build cars. If it causes the person or people who are looking at it to become curious, that in effect means that you've opened their mind. And when people are in a receptive frame of mind, they're calmer. They're not aggressive. They're patient. They want to take something in to understand it better. So to create that opportunity for people is very satisfying. No, I think the one thing that I am reminded of when I look back at the banquet years and the foundations of the avant-garde, I think, well, what was the population of Paris at the time? And now, I mean, when I was born in 1945, there were slightly less than 2 billion people on the planet. Now there's 6 or more.
That's crazy.
So it makes it that much more difficult to identify value in a world that's so congested. And that may be intellectual value, emotional value. It's become very confusing.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend once in finance who started a very successful business in New York, made lots and lots of money, and decided he wanted to start some sort of an art business. And when he looked at the art world, he realized that the one thing that hadn't changed in the art world was the distribution system, that it was essentially the same as it has always been. Select patrons with money to indulge art, a few public institutions, and some commercial galleries. But the quantity of museum-quality art that was being produced was increasing exponentially. And I remember he took a map out of the metropolitan area, and we were downtown, we were in Chelsea, and he stuck the needle of a compass onto Chelsea on West Broadway, and he extended the pencil to create about a 20-mile radius, and he drew a circle with the compass. And he said, within that circle, there's probably $50 billion worth of museum-quality art that nobody will ever see because it's just leaning against the walls of artist studios. And that makes it, you know, all that much more difficult to find an audience, and if you find one, to be able to have something actually to say. So deciding if there's any longer a school of a particular kind of art, surrealism or futurism or cubism, the ismness of art seems to have disappeared.
There's just too much out there at this point. Well, that's depressing.
Well, yeah, but on the other hand, you know, it's good. People who make art are gamefully engaged in an activity that's nonviolent for the most part.
I mean, that's an interesting last thing, though, the sort of paradox of this narcissistic art that, well, narcissism that characterizes a lot of art, and I'd say like self-reflexiveness. You know, you see it in everything from painting to film where people are commenting on themselves and their inner states. So there's this narcissistic element, which I don't mean in a negative way. I just mean it in the literal way. And but then this finding of an audience, like it only takes on meaning unless people see it. That seems to be a paradox, you know?
Well, that's the old story. If the tree falls in the forest, nobody hears it. But the narcissism as a word has had so much negativeness attached to it that people don't realize that there's a very positive side of narcissism. Lewis Hyde wrote a book which is recently reprinted called The Gift, and essentially he delved into the history of why people do extravagant things. And that in
what do you mean by extravagant?
Well, he started with the primitive cultures such as the Northwest Coast Indians, who celebrated a form of ritual called potlatch, in which the chief gave everything he owned away. Mm-hmm. And the more he gave away, the greater his stature was. Then suddenly, somehow, culture has gone full circle, and people are known initially by how much they amass as opposed to how much they give away. An artist makes art. Is he compelled to make art? Is it some sort of an inner drive that means he has to produce something to express himself, and he can't do it in words, so he has to make a physical object? And what's the intent of the art work? Is it first to be to produce it, or is he looking at it like a business to make money with? And I think most of the artists that I've come across who are compelled to make art are compelled to make it for the joy of actually producing it and having someone look at it and comment on it.
Good evening. This has been an interview on Art Waves with Michael Broad, artist and gallery owner. The exhibit, or rather the installation, is called Whoever Emerges. If you'd like to get an idea of what's been described tonight, there's a website that contains an overview and a sort of tour guide experience into the space and installation if you can't actually come and visit it in person, and that is whoeveremerges.com. I've been your host, Mary Brickowski, and you've been listening to Art Waves on WKCR FM New York. It is my pleasure to have you listen to the radio show this evening, and I hope that you join us for more programming. Have a great night.